From Michigan Radio, this is Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Well, the Democrats have descended on Detroit.
Well, let us understand, Detroit was nearly destroyed because of awful trade policy, which allowed corporations to throw workers in this community out on the streets as they moved to low-wage countries.
We'll recap the first of two nights of presidential primary debates, and we'll begin a series of conversations about the role of billionaires in shaping our cities.
The ultra-wealthy often use their money for good causes, but they often have a particular take on that cause. So it's not just investing the money and saying to that organization, you know, you're interested in education, you can figure out how best to advance it. They have an agenda. They often have a solution that they want these organizations to implement.
We'll begin in the city of Detroit. That's coming up on Stateside. From Michigan Radio, you're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us. Well, you may recall in 2016, a little dark horse candidate for president took to the stage of Detroit's Fox Theater, called Marco Rubio Little Marco, and defended the size of his hands to America. Well, Donald Trump would go on to become president of the United States. Last night, it was the Democrats' turn to overwhelm the Fox Theater and Detroit with their numbers and with jabs at one another. It was night one of two for the Democratic primary debate on CNN. Here to rehash the night and the dark psychic forces that emerged from the debate is Adrian Hemond, partner at Grassroots Midwest and a Democratic strategist. Adrian, welcome.
Thanks for having me.
And Bill Nowling, partner at Lambert and a former Republican Party operative. Bill, welcome.
Thank you. Good
you call yourself partisan fluid.
Yeah, I'm partisan fluid.
I really enjoy that. More of us should be, I suppose. Well, let's start there. With one of the few moments of the night that addressed something specific to Michigan, the candidates were asked about the Flint water crisis, and candidate Marianne Williamson had this to say.
I assure you, I lived in Grosse Pointe. What happened in Flint would not have happened in Grosse Pointe. This is part of the dark underbelly of American society. The racism, the bigotry, and the entire conversation that we're having here tonight, if you think any of this wonkiness is going to deal with this dark psychic force of the collectivized hatred that this president is bringing up in this country, then I'm afraid that the Democrats are going to see some very dark days. We need to say it like it is. It's bigger than Flint. It's all over this country. It's particularly people of color. It's particularly people who do not have the money to fight back. And if the Democrats don't start saying it, then why would those people feel that they're there for us? And if those people don't feel it, they won't vote for us, and Donald Trump will win.
So it's an interesting moment because some say that Democrats are playing too much into identity politics, and others say that they aren't enough working on that angle with voters. Adrian, let's start with you. Is this a winning strategy?
Maybe for someone, not for Marianne Williamson, I guess would be my take on that. I don't consider myself qualified to opine on the dark psychic forces piece of that strategy. But in terms of the Flint water crisis, I don't necessarily even consider that all identity politics. Obviously, there was an appeal there. We had an infrastructure problem in this country, and I think it was smart of her to point it out. Unlike a lot of the things that have been talked about in these Democratic debates so far, that's actually something that people can see and feel and touch in their own communities, and there's a lot of it all over America.
Absolutely, but she also got into she ended up addressing specifically reparations, and the question came up about reparations, so they obviously had to address it. She really dug into that, and she got a lot of hits on Google last night, Bill, because of what she was saying. People were holding on to it, but I don't know that it works beyond a primary.
Well, you know, let's be honest about the format that we had here. I mean, it was really a mosh pit of of candidates, and there was, you know, really no ebb and flow or arc to what was going on in the debate. It was a bunch of moderators jabbing one another and goading them into fighting with somebody on the stage to make some interesting TV for 2 hours and 39 minutes, but I wasn't counting. But, you know, I think for Williamson, you know, the thing that struck me about that is that, you know, she was the first one to talk about reparations. And I thought that that might have come up a little earlier, a little, you know, because of all the discussion around race.
Mm-hmm.
I do think it's a bit of a stretch to try to always tie Flint with structural racism or with environmental racism. I think those are factors. But you know, Adrian, I agree with you, you know, there's an infrastructure problem. And for every, for Flint, Michigan, there's, you know, 100 other cities just like it that are ready to go in terms of having that type of infrastructure. So to bring it up, I thought it was smart, but you're trying to differentiate. This is really a battle to see who gets to the next debate, because mm-hmm. they're going to start cutting people off after this. And I think Marianne Williamson was interesting. It was interesting that she was not sticking to the general talking points of most of the candidates up there. It was refreshing to hear that. She's a little out there for my taste, but she was the number one search candidate post-debate.
Right. I actually think she was one of the people who sounded fairly human and like she was talking to people rather than constituents. I thought the big winner
in the debate was the pivot. You know, taking whatever question that the moderator asks you. And if you're Bernie Sanders and you're answering a question about infrastructure and then immediately saying, that's why we need to have Medicare for all and to move on that. They were really focused on playing to the base and to their particular base, where the battle was between, you know, the hard progressive left and the more moderate center, if there is one, in the Democrat Party. You saw that a little bit more last night. I wonder if you're going to see that a little bit more even tonight. You know, you have Biden on there, and I think Biden, he's the front runner. There's a new poll out today from Quinnipiac that has him as a...
Yeah, he's been ahead pretty much the whole time.
Yeah, and he's opening up a little bit, so they're going to go after him on that.
Adrian, did you have confidence coming out of this first night of two in the debates that you have a good field of candidates that Democrats are working with?
No.
Were you disappointed or disheartened?
I wouldn't go so far as to say disheartened, but definitely disappointed. I don't think that that's all on the candidates. Bill referenced this earlier. The format was atrocious and really didn't give the candidates a chance to shine in a way that I think is meaningful to voters.
You didn't get a shine in 2 hours? Not a single shine?
No. I don't yeah. think it was very impressive for any of the candidates, and I think the format had a lot to do with that. The other thing, and Bill raised this as well, most of them were doing a very good job of sticking to their talking points. Marianne Williamson seemed somewhat on the human side, but for the most part, the candidates' performances were pretty robotic, which makes sense given the format that, you know, here's an opportunity to take a pot shot at one of your competitors, ready, set, go. That's not going right. to lend itself to a conversation or really to connecting with voters in any real way. It's an opportunity to take some shots at the other candidates and try and differentiate yourself. They certainly did a lot of the former, but not much of the latter.
I want to play another moment for you as well. This is Bernie Sanders. The subject of Detroit was brought up, and here's what he had to say.
Well, let us understand Detroit was nearly destroyed because of awful trade policy, which allowed corporations to throw workers in this community out on the street as they move to low-wage countries.
That's a pretty simplistic and largely false analysis of what happened in Detroit, but he also pointed out that he won Michigan in 2016. Do you think he could do it again? Bill, I'll start with you.
Yeah, I definitely think he can do it again. I mean, he's the person with the most experience that was on the stage, at least at this level, you know, because he's been there before and he went deep into the primary season the last time around. And, you know, for the progressive left, he still holds a lot of import and sway with voters in that area. They believe him. There's no question in people's mind that Bernie Sanders is a socialist. There was a lot of debate between other people up there, with the exception of Senator Warren, about whether they were really a Democrat or not Democrat.
That was interesting.
You're more of a Democrat than I am, and we should be scared of that. And I, you know, that's normal in the debate. But I think what it comes down to is, you know, this is about not talking. At this stage, it's about not talking yourself off the stage.
Yeah.
And, you know, don't do anything that's going to hurt you. Mm-hmm. You know, what was it? Vince Lombardi said the forward pass, two out of three things can go bad. When you do that in a debate, it's the same thing. Two out of the three things could go bad. And you just don't want to do any harm to it. And so I think that that's what they were trying to do here. Don't kill myself. Maybe take a pot shot when I get an opportunity to do that.
Right.
But when you have 10 people on the stage and you talk to one person, it's 20 minutes before you get back to that person again.
Right.
That's not a debate. You know, that's, you know, what that is.
Yeah, the pot shot is what gets the cheers and jeers anyway in these types of debates.
Yeah, I think that's right. You know, and I agree with Bill that, you know, Senator Sanders has got a chance to win Michigan again. I don't think he's got nearly as good a chance as he did last time, partly because he's not up against, heads up against such a wretched candidate this time. He, you know, he had the great benefit of running in a partisan primary against Hillary Clinton. That was always going to go reasonably well for him. I don't think that that's going to be the case this time. He's certainly going to be up against somebody of a little higher quality as a candidate for president, I would think.
Well, we just have a couple minutes left, and so I want to get a take from you guys on what it's going to take for Democrats to think that they can turn the state back blue into their column. Adrian, start with you.
Democrats have got to figure out a way to connect with voters around, like I mentioned before, sort of kitchen table issues, issues that people can see and touch and feel. You know, that can be the environment, that can be jobs in the economy, but you've got to talk to people about things that actually impact their lives and not in the language of sociology. And I think that there's way too much of that going on in the Democratic Party in general right now, but especially in this presidential primary, a lot of these folks are talking the language of sociology, and most people don't have sociology degrees. That's not a conversation they're interested in having.
Right.
You know, I had the same reaction. It felt like a faculty department meeting last night.
Yeah.
And, you know, which is a lot of people who are really smart talking about really deep issues, not really paying attention to all the things that they agree on and focusing on the things that trying to get the perfect over the practical. You know, I think what Democrats have to do, it's what any candidate has to do, what Adrian said, you know, you got to connect with voters. But I think especially in this election, you know, Michigan, I tend to think that, you know, the last election was, you know, an aberration when it comes to presidential politics. But because this has been a blue state when it comes to the presidential election, and it's going to go back to being a blue state. I think the bigger issue, though, is what is going to, you know, how are Democrats going to connect? If they're going to beat Trump, they've got to pull in moderate Republicans at some level. And how are they going to do that? And I don't care who it is, whether it's a progressive like Bernie or it's somebody, you know, who's arguing more to the middle. They've got to come up with an issue that speaks to those Republican voters that are looking for a reason to not vote Republican.
All right. Well, we have to leave it there. Adrian Hammond and Bill Nowling, thank you both so much for joining me today, and maybe you'll suffer through another night of debates.
Thanks a lot.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, how billionaires are shaping politics and culture in Michigan and around the nation, that's what we're going to talk about next.
The ultra-wealthy often use their money for good causes, but they often have a particular take on that cause.
Stay with us. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis in for Cynthia Canty. You know, a few months ago, Senator Kamala Harris, who is running for president, participated in a CNN town hall, and one young man stood up and asked this question.
In a society where nearly one in five children live in poverty, yeah, is the existence of multi-billionaires morally defensible?
Well, let's just say this. We have had policies in this country, at least in the last 2 decades, that have disproportionately benefited the top 1% to the exclusion of working families.
Harris equivocated a bit in her answer, but the role of the ultra-wealthy in our society is likely to come up more and more often in the next year. Joe Biden, Elizabeth Warren, Bernie Sanders, they all have plans to change taxes for the wealthy. And as we've seen in recent years, billionaires bankroll major political campaigns. But billionaires also invest in the tangible world around us. They build hospitals and schools. They put their names on infrastructure and major developments. And they make decisions with their dollars that impact all of us. Over the next few weeks, we'll look at the influence of billionaires in a few of our own cities. Later in the program, we'll start with Detroit. But first, here to help us understand the role of billionaires in American society is Daryl West. He's vice president and director of governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and he authored a book titled Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust. Daryl, welcome to the program.
Thank you. It's nice to be with you.
I really wanted to talk to you about this idea of wealthification of politics and society. Is there a clear trend that's happening where the uber wealthy are having a larger impact than they used to?
wealthy people are having a tremendous impact on American society, the economy, politics, and philanthropy. I mean, it's an era of great income inequality, so there are people who have an extraordinary amount of money. We're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars up through the billions of dollars. And these people are at the pinnacle of society. People pay attention to what they say. I mean, they are in a major leadership role in the United States.
But is that growing? I mean, I think when you say that we are in this period of income inequality, I think we talk about that and feel that a lot as we look at our cities and rural areas around us. But we also, I think it's easy for us to travel back and look at images and stories from the Great Depression, you know, juxtaposed against billionaires throwing cash into the fireplace, you know, to keep their rooms warm. Is this really a period of income inequality that looks different from what we had before?
I mean, you're certainly right if one goes back 100 years that there was high income inequality at that point. But after World War II, income inequality declined substantially and actually reached a low point in 1976. There were a variety of public policies, tax policies, infrastructure investments, investments in education and healthcare that created a more egalitarian society. But since 1976, we have reverted to the historic pattern. Income inequality today is as high as it was 100 years ago. Hmm. So the pattern over the last 40 to 50 years has been rising income inequality and more wealth in fewer and fewer hands.
Does that mean that we're in some sort of pendulum swing where we're going to see ourselves back into a fiefdom of sorts, or this sort of stratification where we're just talking about aristocracy and you know, people out plowing the fields?
Well, we could be in an era where we maintain high income inequality and basically kind of deal with the status quo that we have and people allow that to continue. But historically, that often has not been the case. There obviously is a lot of concern about income inequality. I mean, one of the reasons why we have slow economic growth is the middle class doesn't have money. You know, the tax cuts have gone disproportionately to the wealthy, and so it's just harder for the average person to pay for education, pay for health care, buy the first home, and do all the things that you need for a vital economy.
You know, in your book that there are several hundred billionaires in America, and that seems like a lot, but it's actually quite a small group of people, obviously, compared to our population. So who are their friends and peers? You know, if there's only a few of them in each state, who do they hang out with?
Actually, wealthy people like to hang out with other wealthy people or people who are prominent in politics, society, or a culture in general. I mean, there are a lot of private clubs, so there are places for these people to gather. Elite universities are a major gathering ground. Some of these people graduated from, you know, the Harvards and the Stanfords and Princetons of the world, and they go back and, you know, regularly engage with those places. So the thing that has happened in the United States is what we call sorting, in which people have sorted themselves out by income level, by education, and a variety of other things. And so there's more segregation across a variety of different dimensions, and a lot of that is linked to income.
It's a self-segregating along, because when I think of self-segregating, I think of groups along ethnicity and racial lines, but you're talking about income brackets as well.
Absolutely. And our society is layered in the sense that, you know, at each level of income, there are different kinds of opportunities. Like, you know, when you're flying on an airplane, there's coach and business class. Mm-hmm. But the really wealthy people have private jets or they have access to corporate jets. So, you know, they're not flying commercial. They have their own airline system, their private schools where the children of the wealthy attend. And so, you know, this self-sorting has intensified as the income inequality has spread. Wealthy people are a little insulated from average people today.
So after they have self-segregated, how do they spend their leisure time? What do most of the uber wealthy in our society do to cut loose?
I mean, I know a number of wealthy people who live in New York City, and the funny thing is there is a certain pattern to their lives in the sense that they're in New York in the spring and fall. in the summer. They go to the Hamptons, and they have parties and socialize with the very people that they know from Manhattan. And then, of course, in the wintertime, a lot of these people go to Palm Beach in Florida. And so they're a little bit like migratory birds that, based on the season, they congregate in different places, but they're still hanging out with each other.
We're speaking with Darrell West. He's vice president and director of governance studies at Brookings. He also authored a book titled Billionaires: Reflections on the Upper Crust, published in 2014. Darrell, you write about billionaires using their money to influence politics and the communities they live in or the society around them. So what are the benefits and pitfalls of someone like a Betsy DeVos influencing education policy or a Dan Gilbert in Detroit building up in a relatively poor city like Detroit?
We see a lot of billionaires who want to influence society and want to influence public policy. So they often have a pet cause that they're really focused on. So in the case of Betsy DeVos, her issue is education. And she's been a big charter school advocate and basically freeing public schools of regulatory constraints so they can become more innovative. So through the foundation, the DeVoses have funded a lot of education causes along the lines of what they want. Dan Gilbert has done the same thing in Detroit. He's been a big investor there, tried to help revitalize the city. So the ultra wealthy often use their money for good causes, but they often have a particular take on that cause. So it's not just investing the money and saying, you know, to that organization, you know, you're interested in education, you can figure out how best to advance it. They have an agenda. They often have a solution that they want these organizations to implement.
It seems to me that that's kind of foisting upon a large population the ideas of the few. Is that sort of the problem that we're bumping up against here?
It is the problem in the sense that, you know, you have the Bill Gates of the world who's done tremendous philanthropy and he's invested a lot in vaccines in the developing world. And I think, you know, everybody would recognize that is a good contribution. There are other people who basically are investing to try and bring about change of a type that they prefer. And so people worry that philanthropy has changed in a particular way that, you know, in the good old days when I was growing up, you know, the wealthy would give a university or give a nonprofit organization money and say, you know, you figure out the best solution. Now the wealthy are very interested in having an impact. There often is a solution that they favor. And so there's more pressure for those nonprofit organizations to act in accordance with the interests of the wealthy.
Well, what happens to a community when it begins to rely on philanthropic money that comes from the uber wealthy? What does it do to a system of government at the community level?
I mean, local communities often are very dependent on philanthropy because, you know, tax revenues have been cut back and taxes have been cut in a number of different communities. And so a lot of municipalities are starved for resources. They face tremendous problems in terms of economic development, income disparities, racial issues, and so on, but they don't have the resources to really address it. And so they often have turn to philanthropists. Newark is an example of this. When Cory Booker was mayor there, Mark Zuckerberg gave the city a huge amount of money for the public schools because he was interested in doing a better job and kind of helping those schools become more innovative. So that's an example of what ultra-wealthy people are trying to do.
Are we seeing any cases where communities are beginning to, or municipalities really, are beginning to rely on philanthropic money more than taxpayer dollars that are coming in the door?
I don't think they're relying more on philanthropy compared to tax dollars, but the amount of philanthropy has increased over time. So they are certainly becoming more dependent on those kinds of dollars and therefore more subject to the whims of the wealthy, you know, whether that whim happens to be good or bad, broad-minded or narrow-minded, local communities are much more dependent on the wealthy for needed services.
How did you become interested in the influence of billionaires?
About 5 or 6 years ago, I was thinking one day just about billionaires who I had encountered, and I realized I did a little mental list, and it had added up to I'd had dealings with about 19 billionaires, which seemed to be a large number.
Yeah.
And so I was thinking that, you know, I could see in an era of income inequality, billionaires were playing a greater role. And of course, today America has a billionaire president. So that's the epitome of this. And so I just wanted to write a book that looked at their role historically, what they're doing in terms of the contemporary period. What has been their impact on the political process? How are they using their money?
Well, what was the most surprising thing to you as you were doing your research for this book?
I mean, the most surprising thing is just how our society has become oriented to wealth really at every level. I mean, wealth is affecting every segment of the economy, every part of society. So I had this term wealthification just to describe how wealth is permeating everything. And, you know, we need to kind of step back and think about that and take a close look at it, because the wealthy often have political views or social views that are different from the rest of society. But because of their money, they have much greater impact, but they're not really representing the views of everybody else. They're representing right. their own views, and their views often are more conservative than exists in the society as a whole.
So these are ostensibly also the job creators that we so desperately need to keep us out of recession. Is that true that when we hear that these are job creators? Are billionaires creating a large share of the jobs that the average worker is in need of?
They certainly have created jobs. There's no question about that. And many of them have been very innovative in terms of their business practices and have altered entire segments of the economy. But if you look at the overall numbers, two-thirds of the jobs in America are created by small and medium-sized businesses. So it's not the large companies that, you know, were founded by billionaires, and they might have started out small or medium-sized companies, but now are mega companies. The engine of job growth in America still is small businesses.
So when we say small business, Daryl, do we mean somebody who owns that business is making employs what, like a dozen people or less? What are the metrics that we sort of base a small business around?
I would say a company that employs less than 100 people, as opposed to, you know, like the Facebooks of the world, which have 25,000 employees,
right.
or Microsoft has 125,000 employees. So we're really talking about those that have fairly modest workforces. But there are a lot of these types of companies. You know, they might start out as a mom and pop shop, and, you know, they hire a few people, the company becomes more successful, and they expand. But those are the companies that are really creating a lot of the jobs these days.
Should we question in our capitalist society the ethics of the existence of billionaires, especially in a country where we still see high rates of poverty, housing insecurity, hunger? I mean, sort of these troubling issues that linger on. And as you said, we're in this era where the disparity is growing, or at least not improving. Is it ethical to even be a billionaire?
I mean, the important thing during a time of great income inequality is to preserve the American dream and economic opportunity for hardworking people. So I grew up on a dairy farm in southern Ohio, you know, family of modest means, but I got a good education, got a PhD, taught at Brown, I work at Brookings now. So I've had tremendous opportunities in my life. I worry that the generations that have come after me, for a variety of different reasons, don't have the same opportunities that I have. So there's nothing wrong with wealth per se, but we have to keep our eye on preserving economic opportunity for everyone. Like, we don't want to become an aristocracy where you have to be rich in order to have economic opportunity, go to the great schools, and be able to carve out a great job for yourself.
We saw a town hall not so long ago where I believe Kamala Harris was asked that same question about whether or not it was ethical to have billionaires or whether we should have billionaires. And barring her answer, which I can't remember off the top of my head, it occurred to me that that might be a question we end up facing more and more. Do you expect that we'll hear that question more in a political arena as well?
The issue of great wealth certainly is on the agenda for the 2020 campaign because of tax policies and the need to repair the social safety net. So people are going to be putting all sorts of ideas on the table. Elizabeth Warren, for example, has proposed a wealth tax, which is, you know, in contrast to an income tax, it would be a tax on the assets of people as opposed to just the income that they make. There's a call for a more equitable tax policy so that if there are tax cuts, they don't go mainly to the wealthy, but they go to the middle class as well. There's a need to invest in education. We know colleges and universities have become very expensive, so it's hard for people of modest means to be able to afford to go to them. So there are a lot of proposals on the table, free community college and free college in general, Medicare for all, that is seeking to address some of these aspects of income inequality.
My last question is about the legacy or the lasting impact of billionaires in general. What do they aspire to leave behind for the most part?
I mean, billionaires are like everyone else in the sense they want to have a positive impact. Now, they've had a positive impact in the business world. They've been very successful. They've accumulated tremendous wealth. But the billionaires I know are not happy just with that achievement. That's quite an extraordinary achievement. They want to have a positive impact on the rest of society. So a lot of them are engaged in philanthropy, and that's certainly a good benefit. They want to bring the knowledge that they accumulated in the business world to improving education, improving healthcare, kind of doing a range of other things. Like, they don't want to just be known as someone who made a lot of money. They want to use their money for good purposes.
Darryl West, thank you so much for joining us today on Stateside.
Thank you.
Coming up, we'll take a look at the impact of billionaires in the city of Detroit. You're listening to Stateside. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Detroit has several billionaires who influence the way the city looks and feels. Among them, Martha Ford, who married into the Ford Motor Company family and is owner of the Detroit Lions. Maddie Maroon, who owns the Ambassador Bridge and recently sold the old train station in Detroit to Ford. The Illiches, who own the Detroit Tigers and the Red Wings and Motor City Casino and, of course, Little Caesars Pizza. And then there's Dan Gilbert, a newer but phenomenally important name in the landscape of billionaires who invest in the city. He founded Quicken Loans and has since transformed the core of Detroit's downtown. This group of people has profound reach in the city. They pour out into the community with their philanthropic investment, and they stretch up into the sky with ownership of some of Detroit's most significant buildings and infrastructure. So how does a city balance the needs of its investors with the needs of its communities, especially when those needs might be at cross purposes? Here to help me unpack the influence of the very wealthy on the city of Detroit is Brandon Snyder, Executive Director of Detroit Action. Brandon, welcome.
Thank you for having us.
And we have Robin Boyle. He's a recently retired professor of urban planning at Wayne State University. Robin, congratulations and welcome to the program.
Thank you very much, Jan. Good afternoon.
So let's start with you, Robin. How do the super wealthy factor into Detroit's modern development strategy?
Well, like any other city on the globe, billionaires like to play in this particular sandcastle. Just think of Monopoly. When you go and play the game, you're after the big bucks and you're after the big property. Cities and wealth go hand in hand. It's a complicated partnership, but it's very much part of the way that cities evolved, particularly in the last 150 years or so. Since about the 1860s, we've seen significant agglomeration of capital focusing on cities where they see, the billionaires, the wealthy, see opportunity to expand their wealth. It goes very much with the territory. Here in Detroit, you've identified several a number of billionaires that are active in cities. That is not unfamiliar. Around the world, around the rest of the United States, the billionaires have a very important part to play. What makes Detroit distinctive, and something I'm sure we will come back to discuss, is the extent to which really two, maybe three, maybe four, if you stretch it, players who do command rankings on the Forbes lists of the wealthiest people in the nation, have had a huge impact in the past, what, decade. I mean, it's that short a time.
Well, let's talk, Brandon, about where we see tangible investment, things that we can see with our eyeballs. I'm thinking of the Q Line, of course, through Dan Gilbert's Bedrock, LCA and the District Detroit with the Illiches. Let's talk about how they've changed the visual landscape.
Yeah, you know, I guess in the last 10 years or so, you know, maybe even shorter than that, the last 8 years, you know, we've seen this massive change in this landscape of downtown from, the, you know, some of those landmarks that you've mentioned. And, you know, what's happened is that, you know, in addition to one of the things that Robin has mentioned, is that this massive, changing or a massive accumulation of capital, you know, we've also seen a massive accumulation of power, you know, be it political power and be it, you know, economic power from those who've developed downtown. You know, Dan Gilbert, who you mentioned, you know, is, a property owner of some 80 some properties downtown. And this has happened just within the last 8 years, where if you were to post housing bubble, post bankruptcy of the city of Detroit. So I think that when we look at, you know, the role of billionaires and we look at, you know, how the influence that they've made in downtown, you know, you can't sort of separate the amassing of capital and the amassing of property with the accumulation of political power.
Well, I want to talk about the benefits and concerns that we're dealing with here. Let's start with the benefits. Robin, what are some of the benefits that we have when we have billionaires investing in cities?
Well, the obvious benefit and one that I would say Dan Gilbert and his family of companies have provided are jobs. Let me just give you one specific example. 10 years ago, the largest employers in the city of Detroit, and I mean the 139 square miles, the largest employers were, and this is not in any particular order, General Motors, the public schools, the city, and the state. Today, the largest employer in the city of Detroit is Gilbert and his families. Around 18,000 people are employed, much more than any of the previous employers that I have just mentioned. Because the car industry, as you know, has been in decline. Ford is not headquartered here. FAC is outside, and they don't have a great deal of construction. So, first and foremost, large-scale investment, whether they're millionaires or mere, you know, if they're billionaires or mere millionaires, mere millionaires,
right.
The most important impact in the short term is the fact that they bring jobs into the city. And in that downtown area, that 7.2, that little area that we talk about as downtown, these jobs have made an incredible difference.
But I would say that out of that, then the concern is probably who they're employing. Am I right, Brandon?
Yeah, absolutely. I think one of the things that you look at when you talk about the jobs that people that have been employed by the Bedrock family of businesses is that many of those jobs, you know, came from downtown, came from the suburbs and were relocated downtown. Many of the folks who are employed are, traditionally much more wealthier, much more college educated, much more white than the city as a whole. And what we see is that, you know, people that like we represent, folks who are, you know, native Detroiters, people who are black and brown, people who, are lower income, you know, and many of the folks specifically, people who have felony backgrounds, you know, aren't employed into the Bedrock family of businesses. And so what we have is, you know, while we have this development and this creation of jobs, what we have is, you know, this development that's sort of unequal and tenuous at best.
Well, let me push back on that
please,
a little bit.
Please.
If I could. I think Brandon is correct. The majority of full-time employees who are coming in under the banner of the billionaires tend to be either people who have come in from the jobs in the suburbs, because he moved his company in 2010 from Livonia, or they are newcomers who have come into the city filling the positions in some of these quite unusual jobs, StockX, for example, who are attracting people from around the country. But let me push back a bit. If you go down into Campus Martius today and look at what happens at lunchtime, you see thousands of young African-Americans pouring out of these buildings. Why? Because Dan Gilbert has one of the largest internship programs in the country dedicated to bringing jobs to young kids for the summer. Now, you say, okay, it's an internship. Does it add up to something? Well, hell yes, it does. It adds up to people giving a chance to get a job in a downtown firm, a chance to perhaps see the opportunities, perhaps to give them a motive, whether you're black, white or indifferent, to stay in school, to finish and to become one of these employees downtown. So while I agree with the fact that a lot of the folks filling the buildings 365 days a year tend to be white, this impact in the summer and the internship programs is not to be dismissed. I think Gilbert has committed to that and has done it now for something like 5 years.
Yeah, but if I may, I think that the internship program represents just a small minority of the whole employees who are at the Bedrock family of businesses. Yes. What you see is, for people who are, black and who are employed and who are a lower income, many of these people make up the positions that are, your people who are in the kitchens, people who are the janitors, people who are the security guards. And what we end up seeing is that, the businesses that employ those folks who are employed by those buildings, don't pay their folks a living wage. So we end up having, again, a really tenuous process of job creation where we're giving away taxes and benefits to corporations who ultimately, trickle down, low paying jobs for local Detroiters. And I think that's one of the things that we look at when we talk about development that's very unequal, very unfair to the folks who are ultimately paying for this development to occur.
If you're just joining us now, I'm Laura Weber Davis in for Cynthia Canty. And joining me is Brandon Snyder. He's executive director of Detroit Action, and Robin Boyle, professor of urban planning, recently retired from Wayne State University. If we can continue on this line a bit, I'm curious, when you have very few wealthy white people making decisions for a city that is populated by hundreds of thousands of black people, and particularly in a city that has a poverty rate that it's as high as it is, are there ways that these investors and the city can be avoiding turning that unbalance into further racial inequity?
I mean, I think one of the easiest ways is, the community benefits agreement process. I think that is a process that
if we can just recap that quickly for our listeners, the community benefits agreement would ostensibly require investors to hire a certain number of Detroiters and locals for their projects.
I think that's one of the processes, but there's also many other agreements that come with community benefits. When the Pistons moved to Detroit and Henry Ford Hospital was being developed, one of the things that they created as an externality was, that we would create basketball hoops and fix up local parks. So there are a number of ways that corporations can work with communities, if they're going to receive tax benefits and tax breaks to move and to develop. One of the things that we believe, is important for corporations like the Bedrock family to, if they're going to move to town, is, again, to hire folks who are from our community and, to work around historic preservation. So groups like Detroit People's Platform, groups like ours, and other community groups have really been pushing to make sure that, the Bedrock family of companies, Chrysler, as well as other folks who are moving into town, really work with surrounding neighborhoods to ensure that the quality of life doesn't change dramatically, but also that people who are in the city are able to be employed because of this changing in development. And I think that's one of the things that we're most interested in when we talk about development for downtown, is that, yearly we have about 5,000 Detroiters who come home from prison throughout the state to Wayne County, and zero of those folks can actually get employed from the Bedrock families.
I mean, I think I agree with almost everything that's been said, and it is important that when companies, particularly companies that get state or local incentives, there needs to be, and in the case of the city of Detroit, there is a requirement that employment is dedicated towards those who live in the city of Detroit. There's a problem, and we know what the problem is, and this is what the pushback is from so many of the companies, is that the skill levels are not there, because the building trades, the construction trades, the welders, the scaffolders, the millwright workers, et cetera, are people who come out of skilled trades. Many of the folks in big cities, not least Detroit, lack these skills. So there has to be a similar public policy platform built to actually improve the training opportunities that there are in the city. And we failed to do that over the years. We simply failed to do it. So now the companies can turn around and say, but we can't get people who work with stone. We can't get people who work with wood. We can't get people who work with steel. We have to go outside. And it's very hard to argue against that if you don't have a pool of skilled trades in the city.
But should the wealthiest investors in the city of Detroit be required to be on the hook for some of that training?
Yes, absolutely. That is what they should be doing. They should be investing in this world. We have reduced the capacity of the public sector in so many fields, not least in skilled trades training. That is, it is behooven to these companies to step up and be much, much more involved in supporting and working directly with community colleges, with other organizations to build a much deeper, much thicker layer of skilled folks who live and work in the city of Detroit.
Agreed. And I think the other thing that to add to that is that many of the labor unions who service these properties or are hired to develop these properties are people who, you know, oftentimes invest in that sort of skills development and skills training, especially at IBEW and other folks who are labor unions here. One of the things that I think that's important to note is that, you know, by investing and allowing people to be a part of unions, be a part of the and be a part of the labor force, you know, there is an opportunity to develop skills, but also an opportunity to reduce turnover, because people who are part of unions, people who are well trained by unions, you know, often stick with the job and often are able to accomplish that job much more effectively.
Robin, I'm curious if Detroit is in some ways particularly vulnerable to being molded by a few moneyed parties, because Detroit has sort of seen this surge in recent years and has seen a lot of devastation over the past 50, 60 years.
Yes and no. I think, let me answer that in a slightly complicated way, and I'll try and keep it quick. A few months ago, I used a social media platform that I'm involved with through work to ask a similar question. To what extent has your city, these are our colleagues who work across the United States of America and Canada, to what extent in your city can you identify the proportion of development occurring similar to that in Detroit? In other words, are you being dominated by particularly very wealthy individuals? And with really just one exception, maybe two, no other place was demonstrating the same sort of impact that the one family, in this case, of course, Dan Gilbert and his range of companies, was having. The other place was Durham, North Carolina, funnily enough. And the other one, and it's a bit of a stretch, is in the Northwest, where in Seattle, there's been incredible investment by a relatively small number of very, very wealthy people, coming out, of course, of the high-tech economy. So yes, in answer to your question, I think a place like Detroit is to some extent vulnerable. But on the other hand, that vulnerability was caused by the exodus of wealth. That vulnerability was caused by those who did own property, who did nothing, sat on their properties, not investing in them, letting them fall apart, or worse still, getting knocked down and becoming car parks, that there was an opportunity for an individual like Gilbert to come in and buy properties at 15 cents on the dollar and then become this really, really large real estate owner here in the city of Detroit. And that then in itself leads, of course, to the problems and the concerns that perhaps we've already discussed.
Well, yeah. Brandon, I'm going to give you the last word here. You want to add on that?
Yeah, the only thing I would add is that, you know, one of the things that makes that particularly dangerous is that it's unequal, and it's, you know, reliant on one family, and it's reliant on one entity. And, you know, as we've seen, you know, with the recent health scares of Dan Gilbert, you know, that makes people and makes investors nervous, you know, if this will continue. So, I mean, I think that the real key is really just trying to make sure that development is spread and spread amongst the many and not just the few, and not just amongst, you know, one billionaire family or one billionaire investor. But how do we make sure that it exists throughout our community for working class individuals?
That's Brandon Snyder. He's executive director of Detroit Action, formerly known as Good Jobs Now, and Robert Boyle. He is a recently retired professor of urban planning at Wayne State University. Gentlemen, both, thank you so much for joining me from Detroit today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Tomorrow on Stateside, we'll talk about the new wave of ticky-tack type apartments going up in cities like Detroit and in your city, too. They're all over the place. I know you haven't avoided seeing them. So look in your city, look at that apartment, and we'll tell you why it looks the way it looks. I'm Laura Weber Davis, in for Cynthia Canty. Thanks so much for joining us.